A one-page tax plan from the White House with big promises and big hurdles. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrian Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks so much for joining us this Wednesday, April 26th. The White House unveiled a one-page set of bullet points today of President Trump's long-touted tax plan. Here's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin in an interview with The Hill.
So this is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country.
Among other things, the plan would cut the corporate tax rate to 15% and reduce the number of personal income tax brackets to 3. It would eliminate most itemized tax deductions, keeping in place those for mortgage interest and charitable contributions. But really, this is the opening salvo. Lawmakers still have to come up with a full plan and pass it. What comes out on the other side could look pretty different. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
On the surface, it seems like President Trump's tax reform plan would be a home run. He's a Republican president. There's a Republican-controlled Congress. What's standing in the way? Well, for one thing, there's the cost. Lindsay Kashgarian is research director with the nonprofit group, the National Priorities Project.
There are Republicans whose primary concern above all else is fiscal responsibility and cutting the deficit. And they're not just going to back down because there's a Republican president.
Take Trump's proposal to cut the corporate tax rate to 15%. On its own, that could add more than $2 trillion to the national debt over a decade. Robert Posen lectures at the MIT Sloan School of Management.
I think that's going to be a big problem for him with members of the Republican caucus who don't want to see that increase in debt.
The same thing goes for cutting the estate tax and other taxes. If those cuts aren't paid for, Trump may have some trouble getting Republicans on board, and it's unlikely he'll get support from Democrats. So what might tax reform look like once it's been put through the ringer in Congress? Eric Hananel at the accounting firm UHY Advisors says at the very least, there'll probably be some decrease in the corporate tax rate, maybe closer to what corporations pay in Europe and Asia.
I think that 20% is more realistic relative to world tax rates. So I think that we're, going to be closer to that.
That is, if tax reform manages to pass Congress. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Key to President Trump's tax plans is accelerated economic growth. The president took to Twitter this morning to complain about modest growth in 2016. He said trade deficits were to blame. Quote, trade deficits hurt the economy very badly. I'll let Marketplace's Sabri Benishore take it from here.
This may shock you, but the president's tweet set some people off. Economists this time.
What the president said this morning is absolutely untrue.
Lee Brandstetter teaches economics at Carnegie Mellon. It's true the economy slowed down in 2016, but the trade deficit hasn't changed much in the past 5 years.
Because that hasn't been changing, you can't really attribute the slower growth to any changes in the trade deficit.
Doug Irwin is professor of economics at Dartmouth. Trade deficits do not, as a rule, hurt the economy.
If you look historically, when we have a growing, robust economy, we have a larger trade deficit.
That's because as the U.S. economy grows compared to the rest of the world, we buy more things, so our imports go up. There are a lot of reasons the U.S. economy didn't excel last year. It's just that the trade deficit had nothing to do with them. Josh Bivens is at the Economic Policy Institute.
The weakness we saw in 2016, it was really broad-based. It was consumption. It was investment. So I think it's tough to put it all on the trade deficit over the past year.
The idea behind the president's statement is that if we took our spending on imports and shifted it to the U.S. economy, we would see growth.
That's not the way the economy operates.
Bob Murphy teaches economics at Boston College.
The trade deficit is the result of what's going on in the economy.
Not, he says, a driver. Dartmouth's Doug Irwin says blaming the trade deficit is kind of backward.
Like you want to reduce auto emissions, so you just take off the tailpipe or plug it up.
Ironically, he says the president's spending plans, if they result in more government borrowing, are likely to make the trade deficit get bigger. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
ESPN announced a long-rumored round of layoffs today. Cuts include on-air reporters and commentators. It's a clear sign of the troubles facing the sports network, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
ESPN used to be parent company Disney's cash cow, but things have changed. The problem is simple, says Rodney Fort, a professor of sport management at the University of Michigan.
Costs appear to be rising for broadcast rights, and there appear to be fewer eyeballs focused on the ESPN product.
ESPN has lost more than 12 million cable and satellite subscribers in the last 5 years. Fewer eyeballs means less ad revenue at a time when ESPN and other providers are paying more than ever before to broadcast live games. Adam Grossman is with Block 6 Analytics.
The NBA tripled the value of its rights deals in its latest negotiation with ESPN, Turner, TNT.
ESPN is paying $1.4 billion a year to broadcast pro basketball games until 2025, and a total of more than $7 billion in broadcast rights this year, more than any other media network. And Grossman says more well-funded competitors are getting into the space.
Twitter's had the NFL contract this year where they paid $10 million in order to broadcast 10 games. This year, it is reported that Amazon is paying $50 million for the same 10-game package. Facebook Live is already broadcasting sports events.
Michael Colangelo at USC Marshall's Sports Business Institute says ESPN is simply adapting to the new reality.
There's going to be a lot more competition, and as we know, the more competition, the higher the price may get driven up.
Today's major round of layoffs at ESPN is the first since 2015, when the network cut 300, mostly behind-the-scenes positions. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The markets today were more or less flat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All this week, we have the latest results from our Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll. One thing we heard loud and clear this time: people feel forgotten by Washington, D.C. 3/4 of respondents said as much. Marketplace's Annie Baxter goes in search of why.
Do you think the government in Washington generally represents your interests, or has the government forgotten about people like you? That was the new question we asked in our latest poll. Glenn Perkins is a 60-year-old truck driver near Nashville, Tennessee, who responded to our poll. He says Black Americans like him...
We're the forgotten Americans. We're swept under the rug. To make a change, they're going to specifically have to say that there is a problem going on in Black America.
For Perkins, that would mean Washington tackling African Americans' high unemployment rates and investing more in public schools. He thinks the charter schools and vouchers championed by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos won't serve the needs of Black families. Perkins is a Democrat who didn't vote for President Trump. But another poll respondent, Fred Cousins of Fort Smith, Arkansas, did. You might think having his guy win would eliminate that forgotten feeling, but Cousins is ambivalent.
And I'm trying to decide how I feel.
Cousins is 80 and a former furniture maker. He likes Trump's focus on keeping jobs from going offshore, and he admires Trump's appointees, especially Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. But Cousins can't seem to shake the notion that Washington politicians may not have his back.
They speak one way and dance another, and will they perform? Who knows?
Well, there is a great deal of frustration with Washington, and virtually every poll, no matter what question is asked, shows that.
Stephen Smith is a political scientist at Washington University in St. Louis. He says surveys show public trust in the federal government has been falling for decades, with only a few periods of temporary improvement. Feeling forgotten is just another way to express Americans' distrust. Smith says it comes down mostly to this. Washington politicians can't seem to find common ground to accomplish things that could actually help people, like fixing health care.
Instead, what we see is the scoring of political points against each other. We see stalemate, and we see relatively little action on moderate proposals or on compromises that could move things forward. That breeds frustration on the part of everyone. It leads to very low ratings for the president, even lower ratings for Congress.
But there are ways to mitigate that frustration, according to sociologist Arlie Hochschild. She's written about the feeling of forgottenness among Tea Party voters in rural Louisiana. She has this advice for voters.
Get active and go to those town meetings. And in other words, try to get seen.
She says the more citizens feel seen and heard, the less forgotten they will feel. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Over on our website, you can find out more about our poll. Take a couple of minutes, answer our short economic anxiety quiz, see where you fall on the economic stress spectrum, and we've laid out some of the key poll findings in a video. Check it out. It's all at marketplace.org. Once a year, journalists and Washington elites call a truce and throw a party in Washington, D.C., the White House Correspondents' Dinner, also known as Nerd Prom. The dinner is on for this Saturday. Back in 1921, when it started, about 50 people attended. Now the guest list is a couple thousand. There's a red carpet, celebrities, pre-parties, after-parties. This year, unusually, there will be no president. President Trump is holding his own rally in Pennsylvania. But it's not the first year the event has caused controversy. Patrick Gavin is a filmmaker and journalist. He made the documentary Nerd Prom: Inside Washington's Wildest Week. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So how has it changed? What happened to bring in all these parties and pre-parties? And how has the mission shifted because of it?
Well, I think that people realize that there was a great opportunity to kind of glom onto this weekend, to not only throw parties to promote your brand or to promote your television shows or to thank your advertisers, but to also kind of show that you carry some moxie in this town. And that's sort of what a lot of it is. You know, if you are Verizon or if you are Comcast or whatever it is, you know, by throwing a big party, a big event, it's a great way to show that you are a major player in a town in which that's incredibly important to do that.
I understand that as it became more and more of a scene, some big name journalistic organizations pulled out. Is that right?
That's right. The New York Times has sort of barred its reporters from going to the actual dinner for a number of years, although they're free to go to any parties they want. You know, BuzzFeed now really doesn't go to the dinner. They throw their own party. This year, Vanity Fair and Bloomberg have canceled their after party. So more and more, I think people are starting to see this weekend for what it is, which is not the greatest representation. I think that if you are somebody watching this dinner on C-SPAN, and you see reporters and politicians and everybody who's in this town in theory to serve the public, and you see them essentially patting themselves on the back and hobnobbing with celebrities, and I think it rings hollow with people back home. I mean, Washington, D.C.'s approval rating is in the toilet. Mm-hmm. Reporters' approval rating is in the toilet. Congress, et cetera, et cetera. So for us to every year have this Super Bowl where the whole point is to congratulate ourselves and to talk about how amazing we are and to go to these elegant parties really just doesn't sync well with, I think, how people outside D.C. view us. And I don't think we represent ourselves very well.
How is the relationship between the Trump administration and the press now changing things this year for this event?
Trump is certainly changing this weekend in unique ways. I mean, I think Vanity Fair and Bloomberg specifically are canceling their party in large part as a maybe not so subtle protest against Trump's attitude towards the press. But, you know, from my vantage point, that's a little bit too little too late. I mean, if the idea is that you want to protest presidents with bad press policies, you know, Obama had a pretty bad policy towards the press and no one canceled their parties for him. So I think for everybody to all of a sudden get a bit of courage, maybe because it's more popular to not like Donald Trump now than it was under Obama, you know, it seems a little bit too little too late. But I also think people who care about White House journalism never have a spotlight like they do that night, where millions of people are tuning in on TV or later online. And if they could use that attention and all the celebrities and the paparazzi and the red carpet to really try to educate people about what is the very important cause of White House journalism, then you could sort of make, you know, lemonade out of these lemons, I think.
You think that could happen this year?
No, it never does. But they ought to. I mean, it's an important cause and they're the best people to do it.
Patrick Gavin is a journalist and director of the documentary Nerd Prom: Inside Washington's Wildest Week. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
everyone has been sort of waiting for another splashy lawsuit that will expose what Hollywood does.
Sounds like a job for one of England's loudest bands. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 21 points, a tenth percent, to close at 20,975. The Nasdaq shaved less than a point, essentially unchanged, to finish at 6025. And the S&P 500 shed a point to end at 2387. We mentioned that ESPN announced about 100 layoffs today. The sports network is operated by Disney, which kicked up a third percent. U.S. Steel is feeling the heat after reporting a first quarter loss and cutting its profit forecast. U.S. Steel rolled down more than 26%. Bonds rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. While a lot of today's attention was on tax reform, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai was making news of his own, outlining what might be next for net neutrality. Chairman Pai wants to roll back Obama-era regulation on internet service providers and says high-speed internet service shouldn't be treated like a public utility. Marketplace's senior tech correspondent Molly Wood is here to help us make some sense of this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Adrienne.
I wonder if we can back up here for one second and just talk about net neutrality. Remind us what we're talking about.
When we talk about net neutrality, we are talking about protections, regulations that ensure that the providers of internet service cannot discriminate against any services, that they have to provide all services and treat all traffic on the internet equally. So it is often referred to as regulating the internet. What it really is regulating the internet service providers.
So what Chairman Pai announced today, what did he do?
He essentially kicked off his campaign to change net neutrality regulation. And he signaled that his approach is going to be really broad. He said that he will release a complete order to the public tomorrow and will have a long public comment period, but that he intends to pursue a pretty dramatic change.
What are we expecting from his plan tomorrow?
Chairman Pai wants what he has referred to and what was referred to over and over in this press conference today, a very light regulatory framework. We suspect that what he wants to do is have ISPs voluntarily regulate themselves. So internet service providers would not be classified as utilities, which they are currently, and that there wouldn't necessarily be specific restrictions in place about how much ISPs can charge, which is what they're really about worried about, rate changes, or what kinds of traffic they maybe can allow to go through faster or slower.
Just stripping aside all the sort of insidey tech stuff, what would this actually mean for me sitting at home watching Netflix on my couch?
That, unfortunately, is the bulk of the entire argument. So those on Chairman Ajit Pai's side say that what it would mean for you is greater innovation, greater competition in the web space, and that it would mean that telecom providers like these big ISPs, AT&T, Comcast, that they would have more incentive to build out their infrastructure, that it would mean you could get, you know, you'd be more likely to get fast access at home, or if you live in a rural area, that they'd feel like, okay, look, we have no restrictions on our ways to make money, so we have plenty of incentive to build our infrastructure. On the other side, Opponents of Pai's plan and proponents of strong net neutrality regulations say that it would probably mean rate increases, that it could mean discrimination against certain kinds of traffic on certain networks, say Comcast, who owns NBC Universal, might say you have to subscribe to Comcast service and our TV service or else you can't get Netflix. That's sort of the worst case scenario on the other side.
So where does this debate go after tomorrow? It goes for public comment, you said, and what after that?
It will go to public comment, and then it will eventually go to a vote with the FCC. But there are hints that the ultimate goal is to basically take this whole issue and put it before Congress, because this is the third time that the FCC has taken up the question of net neutrality. It is highly contentious. It's very partisan and politicized. In fact, I was very surprised at Chairman Pai's tone in talking about this today and how dismissive he was of every other argument that's come before. So a lot of people in the middle of this argument that say what we actually need is a long-term, relatively nonpartisan, lasting legislative answer to this question so that it doesn't keep ping-ponging back and forth between, you know, partisan FCC commissioners.
Molly is Marketplace's senior tech correspondent and co-host of our new podcast, Make Me Smart. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Adrian.
Many of you probably know and can even quote the 1984 mockumentary This Is Spinal Tap about a fictional, very loud, heavy metal band.
Rock and roll!
Rock and roll!
Hello, Cleveland! Hello, Cleveland!
Much like the band's failed entrance onto that Cleveland stage, the movie's box office take was a letdown. $4.7 million. But in the years since, it's become a classic. Now, the four creators of the film, including Harry Shearer and director Rob Reiner, are suing the company that owns the rights for $400 million. In this week's Bloomberg Businessweek, reporter Robert Kolker takes a look at their claims. Thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be here.
And this is a pretty well-loved film. You report that the creators have made almost nothing for it. How's that possible?
Well, they signed what was a pretty short but standard deal at the time with Embassy Pictures, which went out of business shortly thereafter. And then the rights to the movie shifted from owner to owner until now they're finally with Vivendi. And according to the contract, all the creators of Spinal Tap, that's the three members of the band and Rob Reiner, the director, are entitled to back-end participation, that is to say profits. But according to Vivendi, they only made something like $81 for merchandising and $98 for songs, each of them. It's hard to believe that a movie that's been circulating for so long and adored by so many wouldn't pay off anyone who's entitled to the back end. But these guys have gotten basically nothing.
Talk me through sort of the accounting that goes into this. What do we know about how Vivendi's coming up with this number?
Well, more will come out probably as the litigation proceeds and if an audit actually happens. But, well, the running joke in Hollywood is that no movies ever make money and that if you want to, have a back-end participation in a movie, good luck finding the back-end. The profit just isn't going to be there. And the most significant lawsuit decades ago about this was the Coming to America lawsuit that Art Buchwald filed. He wrote a treatment and had an idea for a movie, and Paramount bought it, and they promised him a piece of the profits, and Coming to America made $288 million and yet somehow didn't make a profit. Hmm. But that case settled before Paramount's techniques and tactics could really be exposed to the public. And so everyone has been sort of waiting for another splashy lawsuit that will expose what Hollywood does.
And is this that lawsuit, you think?
I think potentially it is, because you've got four guys who aren't interested in settling and who are interested in, you know, being influential and helping young creators like the people they used to be decades ago.
And Harry Shearer here is sort of leading the charge. Is that right?
Right. And he's the one who initially filed the lawsuit. But then in February, he was joined by the rest of the band. And they all are saying the same thing. And so suddenly it becomes a much more significant potentially for Hollywood, not necessarily because of the money at stake, but because of the publicity it can engender and because of what it can expose about the techniques that all studios use to sort of move money around so that movies don't make profit.
Could this case be precedent setting in that way? I saw an editorial he wrote in Rolling Stone basically saying this is for all creators. But does it have the potential to do that going forward, to actually impact creators today?
I think the most likely scenario of it having an impact is if they don't settle and this winds up in court and suddenly it will be bad publicity for the entire industry. And so Hollywood studios will be shamed into changing their practices or making them a little bit more transparent. That's what makes this case so special. I don't think they're going to settle. I don't think Harry Shearer has any motivation to settle. He's not doing this for money. He's doing this because he feels like he's wearing the white hat here. And he thinks that he can probably strike a blow for truth and justice here.
Robert Kolker is a reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This final note before we go today, a detail that reporter Sarah Cliff over at Vox spotted in a leaked amendment to the Republicans' health care bill. The proposed amendment would allow states to opt out of some of the Obamacare rules, like charging people with pre-existing conditions the same as healthy people. But Cliff and her sources noticed the amendment exempts legislators and their staff from the change, meaning they'd be guaranteed access to those provisions even as their constituents could lose them. It appears some Republicans are now working to take the exemption out, and still no word on how it got there in the first place. Today, the Dow dropped 21 points, a 10%. The Nasdaq shaved off less than a point, essentially unchanged. The S&P 500 also finished almost flat. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the program for us. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.